Welcome to the Gen Z Stoic Podcast,
where every week we strive to lead younger generations on a path to virtue through the insight of Stoic teachings and personal stories from our lives as Gen Z Stoics.
We'll figure something out.
So we're very resourceful. No, but I was thinking this week, because I've been listening to a lot of Rogan, and I was like, if there's one person who, when I look at their life and... Because how old's Rogan? Is he like, he's in his 60s, right?
No, Rogan is 56 years old.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah. But in 40 years, if I'm like living his life, like I think I would be the happiest person in the world. Like, get to commentate on UFC and just sit ringside for every UFC fight that I want to. Have a podcast where I get to talk to a bunch of interesting people and make an impact that way. Like, train and everything. Just go to comedy clubs all the time, do stand-up. I probably wouldn't be good at stand-up. I'm way too serious.
No, don't forget, dude. This dude is in, like, extremely good physical health.
Well, yeah, he looks like he's, like, 30. And he's, like, he's... Like,
yeah.
Like, well, it's because he has, like, all the money and resources to do that. That's, like...
Yeah, but he built it up slowly. I mean, he built that, like, that's the only way to do it is over time. I mean, he's 56 and he's, like, he's had everything he's had for, I mean, not extremely long. It took him a bit, but built his way up.
Well, I'm under the belief that he's genuinely like a good person. You know, hear the stories of him. He sticks by the right people. That's why he's commentating on UFC and everything, is because he stuck up for them when it began. And you had the boxing crowd being like, this is not a real sport. And he was like, no, it's better than boxing. There's that YouTube video or YouTube short where he just goes at it with this boxing dude on ESPN. So it's just things like that. And I feel like if you embody his characteristics, it's not a bad role model to have. Well, I just know a lot of Rogan this week.
Well, on his podcast too, like it's not really a structured conversation that much. Like, he definitely has questions that he asks his guests and whatnot, but overall it's pretty laid back and just two people, you know,
man. Well, yeah, it's kind of like the podcasting thing, right? Where you kind of master how to transition into a topic without like, see, like I'll use an example. Like, he had Tony Hinchcliffe on from Kill Tony. It was 2 weeks ago or a week ago. I just listened to it this week. And without explicitly trying to like get him to talk about the Tom Brady roast, because Tony fucking, he killed Tom Brady. Like, absolutely killed Tom Brady.
Yeah.
But they're like talking about something. Oh, they were talking about Tony's idea for a movie. And he's like, you should really know what a good platform for that would be? Netflix. Speaking of Netflix, what about the, and I was like, okay, that's pretty cool. Yeah. We haven't gotten there yet, but I feel like we've progressed with guests to where like we're sort of doing that. It's a little bit rough still, but like we've still,
it's also hard because we're not in person. Like, I feel like it'd be a lot easier in person when we're all three in different places. Like, I'm here, you're at your house, and our guest is in like a different continent, you know? So
yeah, that's certainly true. I don't know. That feels like kind of an excuse though, because I think we still can get a lot better.
No, I'm not saying we can't get better. I'm just saying once we have like a studio and a place that we can host, like an actual, you know, place.
Studio where the background isn't like bed sheets that have been hung up.
Or just my room, bro. This is all part of the beginning, though. I mean, yeah, we're still only, I don't think we've even hit 100 episodes published yet. Like,
no, I had to go back for our pre-meet the other day and like look to answer a question, look at how many we've done. I think we're like at 65 episodes now, including like the Stoic readings and everything. So the statistic is what, like 400 and some episodes?
Yeah, it was around 400 to blow up, but that's the average, right? So it could be more than that or it could be less.
Yeah.
So I saw this thing and I might have misinterpreted, but it was like most podcasts, in order to do well, have to do more than 21 episodes, and most people don't do more than 21 episodes. It was Alex Hormozy. Is that how you say his name? You know what I'm talking about? The guy with the long hair who's really jacked.
I know who you're talking about. I have no clue what his name
Alex,
is.
Alex. Yeah, Alex Hormozy. And I think it was something on his page, and it was like most, like the top 1% of podcasters do more than 21 episodes. And I'm like, really? Because I feel like we're definitely not in the top 1%, but we have like a lot of episodes.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say Alex Jones, and I was very concerned.
I know who that is.
Speaking of Rogan, have you seen that video, or not that video, but like on the Rogan episode, he got like choked unconscious
by who?
I forget. I think it was like, it wasn't like a It was a professional like MMA fighter. Yeah, but like he asked for it. He's like, choke me out, choke me out.
Joe Rogan choked the guy out.
No, not Joe Rogan. Rogan didn't. It was somebody else.
Oh. Yeah. He got choked out.
He just goes unconscious. His face during that is so funny. No, Rogan didn't choke him out. He fought Shane Gillis, though. That was pretty funny. There's a picture of that where he's like smiling and he's like got him in an armbar.
Isn't it? Have you seen the show that Shane Gillis is in with the tires? I think it's called Tires. I think that's what the show is called.
I've seen it. I haven't watched it. Yeah. Like for me, my perspective, and maybe this is because I haven't checked it out a lot, is that stand-up comedians do not do well in TV shows. Like it's not their like specialty, their arena, but like their comedy doesn't translate as much. Now, Shane Gillis, I think, is just so naturally funny. That's probably not true. But like a lot of stand-up comedians, you see them like transition from like just doing that to like the TV show. And I don't know, their humor doesn't like come off as much in that format.
I think the only example I can think of that is there's this older comedian named Jim Gaffigan, and he was in a movie and it sucked and it like really wasn't that good. But I think it's just because comedians are so used to being themselves on stage. Like they're just naturally funny with who they are that when they have to act, it's just not that good.
Well, and some of the best stand-up comedy is crowd work, right? And that's just like, that's improv.
Yeah, like Matt Rife. He has insane crowd work. Like,
I don't know.
That's a controversial like person to talk about right there, but his crowd work is pretty freaking good.
I don't know. I don't find him that funny anymore. Because, I don't know, his crowd work like is great, but it like feels repetitive.
Well, yeah, he does some of the same stuff on like the same like tours and stuff with just different people. And then But, I mean, that's kind of what you have to do.
Stand-up comedy for me. I kind of want to – I've never been to a stand-up comedy show. I just see, like, clips of it on the internet. I kind of want to go to one of those at some point.
I want to go to one where there's food, like, if you get to eat and then watch people do comedy. I don't know. I just okay. – I went to a musical this one time, and it was the Boulder Dinner Theater, and you got, like, a nice dinner, and then you got to watch a musical, and it was the best thing ever because there was food. Like, the food made it so much better because – if I go to a musical in Denver and I'm at like the Denver Theater of Performing Arts and I'm sitting there and I have to pay like $30 for a thing of caramel corn and I'm starving and it's hot and I'm thirsty, whereas I could sit in an air conditioned venue with food and then watch it. Like it's better.
Okay. I mean, you're still paying for the food.
Yeah. But at least you're getting your money's worth of food though, you know?
I guess. I don't know. It's just kind of that idea, like we were talking like before we hit the record button about like the side hustle stuff and like wanting to make money. It's like things like that, those experiences, like I want to save to the point where like if I'm just spending money on it, like I don't have to like worry about it. Because that's for me, like I want to get to a point, we talk about a lot about like money being a preferred indifferent. You can't really, I don't think, be at that point at this age because like you don't know where you're at in life and you have to provide, you have to. Like we're both getting our own place now and we're having to figure out rent and everything. So it's not a preferred indifferent because if we don't have money, like we don't have a place to live. And that's something like you can be as stoic or as philosophical as you want. Like if you don't have a roof over your head, that's going to be pretty bothersome. So I'm just trying to get to a point. I think we're both trying to get to a point where like we have so much money saved up and invested and just kind of recurring as passive income where you can just spend money on what seems enjoyable and like not worry about it.
Well, and that's the thing too, is it wasn't this expensive to just live before. Like,
oh my God. I went and got a Red Bull because I was writing a paper, or no, I was doing that presentation I was talking to you about, like a 30-minute presentation. Yeah. And it was like 9 p.m. and I was like, I'm not doing this without Red Bull. So I went and got just a regular sized can of Red Bull and a pint of ice cream. Not healthy whatsoever. Very bad for the diet. But that's such a
like big school project. Food though.
It was $10. It was $10 for those two things. And then I compared it like the other day, I got this like nice pizza and it was like $8 for the pizza. It doesn't make sense to me. And I'm sitting there like thinking in like the self-checkout, like how did we get to a point where a Red Bull and a pint of ice cream, which probably costs what like $1 combined to produce and package, is now $10. That's insane.
Well, there's these houses, so like below my campus, there's these houses that are, they're like not even that big. Like they're these little like stacked on top of each other homes, and they're nice, but there's not a lot of room. They're not beachfront, nothing. It's $9,000 a month to rent.
Well, yeah, that makes sense because it's LA.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, though, is LA's like always been like up there, but it's never been like that up there. I didn't realize how expensive it was. And it's not a big house. It's like a 2-bedroom house, and it's not a lot of square footage.
And it kind of sucks for you, too, because like that's kind of offset because in California, they generally pay more. And now they have like the minimum wage stuff where it's an insanely high minimum wage.
It's like almost 18. I think it's 17.
Yeah. So they pay more. But like when you're like a college student and you're working those minimum wage jobs, it doesn't really translate. Like that only translates when you're like actually in the middle of your career and like can kind of afford that. That's like I don't get that either, the discrepancy between states. Like, I would much rather, like, I know LA has all those amenities and, like, the people and everything, but, like, you consider that compared to, like, you can buy, like, a mansion in, like, Arkansas or Alabama or Mississippi for, like, 300 grand. Like, I get, like, the difference there of temperature, people, attractions, everything, but, like, really? Like, just, like, you feel cool because you're in LA. That's worth paying 9 grand a month for when you're paying less per month for a literal mansion in the South. I don't know. I have a lot of family in the South, so I'm kind of biased, but
yeah, but I don't have any family in the South. And the thing, like, I couldn't live in LA long term. I couldn't really live in any city that's that condensed long term simply because you don't really have location freedom at all. Like, I saw this thing that was like, if there was ever this is obviously theoretical, but if there was ever like an apocalypse, like how I would get out is like just driving out. Like, if we're in the country, right, you can just drive basically anywhere you want. If you're in the city and something happens, you can't get out. Like, you're jam-packed in there.
Or in an apocalypse, you can just have your own island, and it doesn't apply.
Which we did talk about having our own island, and I think it's a very good idea.
Future goal.
I think it would actually be run very well and very efficiently.
Well, yeah, because it's us too, so there would be no crimes, no trafficking or anything, no Epstein Island situation. Just the Stoic Island.
If everything was Stoic... Well, actually, if everything was Stoic, nothing would be Stoic. But if we ran our own Stoic Island...
I don't think that's true.
Well, if everybody...
A society where everyone's Stoic? I feel like that's an idea. I mean, for us, that's like kind of an idealistic society.
Yeah, but it's not feasible. And if it were the case, like if everybody were so good at regulating their emotions all the time and everybody was like the same, then nobody would be standing out. Like, it would just be normal. And then there'd be like this new standard
that we'd all... Okay, but like, consider... Like, we're, like, here right now in society. We're at, like, a 2 out of 10. If everybody becomes Stoic, we're, like, at a 6 out of 10. So, yeah, like, everybody's the same, so nobody's special. But, like, the floor has been raised so much that I think society just produces more, and it's a better society.
No, it's true. And the only reason we would ever know that is because we've experienced what it's like to live at a 2 out of 10 level. But I'm saying if, like, you've always been at a 6 out of 10 level and everyone's Stoic, then it's going to feel like it is now. You know what I mean?
I guess it kind of depends like then like what part of the wave you're on. Like if you're somebody who is like one of the first people, then you inspire a lot of people to like follow in your path, then you feel good. But like if you're one of the last few people and you just like look around and everybody's doing better than you are, and so you're like, finally, I guess I have to change, then it kind of sucks. But I don't really feel bad for those people because they made a conscious choice to wait so long to improve themselves. So it's kind of like, oh, well, I mean, that's what you get for waiting so long.
No, and I agree. I think society like as a whole would be like far better off, and we'd get a lot more things done, and we'd have a lot less issues, and in my personal opinion, a lot less war. But the thing that's kind of interesting is, and it sounds kind of bad to say this, but I'm kind of glad that there's people who are like not interested in improving themselves at all, because it makes things a lot easier for the people that are, you know what I mean? It's kind of like the people who don't want to work hard, it makes things easier for the people who do, because it sets like a new low bar. Not that I'm saying we want to like...
Oh, no, I agree completely. I mean, but look at our generation, yeah.
We don't want people to suck, but it's like, if you're going to suck, it's going to make all of us look better. You know what I mean? Like, if you're just going to be down there all the time, and we're just going to be, you know, we're going to keep climbing, and we're going to keep going up and up, that's going to make us look better. But it's not, I mean, it's a... That's not thinking about it stoically. Thinking about it stoically, we want everybody to be from down here, up here. We want to elevate everybody around us, right? But not realistically, but if you look at it just in that lens, that if there's people who are slacking, and it's going to make it easier for the people who are working harder to do more, because there's not as much, you know, competition. That's why they say it's easier to get rich now more than ever. It's because we have all these resources, but nobody's utilizing them. So all the people that are just getting ahead and ahead and ahead.
Yeah, I don't think it's a Stoic contradiction to say that, like, there are some lost causes out there and that benefits us. I think it's because it's not like Seneca was out there teaching the masses, right? Like, he wrote letters to, like, one dude, and that was, like, the role model that he presented himself as. Marcus Aurelius was, like, a famous leader, but, like, he wasn't teaching the masses and trying to improve the masses. You want to improve society, and you obviously want to idealistically have, like, that cosmopolis where, like, we are one global society that shares the same values. But it's not, I mean, it's out of our control to change other people, right? Basic Stoic principle, dichotomy of control. So if there are lost causes out there, which there certainly are, there's people who are never going to come around to, I should better myself for positive values, and they're just going to stick in their negative space. But we can't control that. So if we say, you know what, that's fine, we can't control that, we stand to benefit from it, like, sure. That's completely fine in my eyes. Because why would you waste energy on people who don't want to, you know, listen to what you're saying?
Well, that's the thing, is all we can really do is put the message out. I mean, all we can really do is give them the idea and the tools and the resources and point them towards it. But, I mean, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. It's that same principle. You're not going to waste all your energy, like, forcing people to do what you think is right or making them do this or that, because you can't. It's not going to work. We're just doing what we can, essentially, and we'll keep doing our part. But not everybody's going to agree or try it out. So,
well, and it looks different for everybody too. Like, we've put the message out there for a year and a half now, and I think instead of, like, to, like, visualize it, instead of us, like, putting the message out there, somebody grabs onto it, and then we just, like, grab them by the shoulders and, like, this is how you do it, this is how you do it, this is how you do it. Like, it's sometimes better to just put the message out there and let people interpret it themselves. Now, some people apparently interpret that as, you know, you and I being Christian nationalists and things of that nature,
which is very, don't forget that.
Yeah, very funny. I mean, very funny that I'm a Christian nationalist when I've expressed my trepidations with Christianity on the podcast. But, you know,
that's the art of social media, is your entire depth of character is determined by a 20 to 30 second clip on the internet. And if people who are so witful come across these clips, they can determine the entirety of your worth and your being based off of that one clip. So, thank you for the people that have figured us out based off of those clips. You really,
they figured out the secret agenda, actually.
Yeah, our agenda is hidden behind Stoicism, right? We're actually pushing for a nationalist, Christian nationalist, neo-Nazi type thing. That's actually all we're about.
I don't know if you've been watching, like, Ryan Holiday's been doing a lot of TV interviews because he's publishing a new book. So he's going around promoting the new book.
I've seen a lot of the things about the new book.
Well, these TV interviewers are just, like, so dumb and, like, try and paint Stoicism as this negative light when they clearly don't even know what it is. Like, before I joined Riverside, I was, like, watching clips, or while I was waiting for you to, like, join, I was watching, like, Instagram and, like, going through an account, and there's this interview with CNBC where, and, like, they try to paint him as, like, being a psychiatrist rather than an author and, like, this, like, master of philosophy and everything, and just, like, just a negative connotation to all the questions. And just people are so negative with their, like, stereotypes. Like, people have no clue what Stoicism really is, but they, like, they've heard, like, Andrew Tate talked about Stoicism twice, or, you know, Jordan Peterson talked about Stoicism a couple of times, and they're like, oh, these guys talked about it, it has to be bad, it's awful, so we're just going to come in with negative connotations.
That's the problem, is you see the elitists and they're, like, saying, you know, they're not great people, or they say not great things sometimes, or just very out of pocket things simply for marketing purposes. And then they see that and they're like, that's the entirety. And then it's just a hasty generalization, which is, in my opinion, one of the worst logical fallacies to commit. But unfortunately, that's pretty much everywhere with people growing on social media and just viral clips going everywhere, is hasty generalizations about, you know, specific areas of study, in this case, philosophy, Stoic philosophy, are being thrown around everywhere. And then, like you said, we're getting a negative light. But you said it was CNBC?
Yeah.
Is that like a major, that's a major media?
CNBC, I think it's like the business kind of focus of NBC. So it's pretty neutral on, like, the political bias chart. I think some of it has to do with agenda too, because Stoicism is a lot of Stoicism, I think, is an antidote to what we see messaging wise with, like, today's society, where we see a lot of victimhood and victim mindset. And I think that's like on both sides of the political aisle and every facet of life. There wants to be kind of this permeation of and spread of just a victim mentality. And that goes towards like, oh, you know, you've been oppressed for X, Y, and Z reason for so long. Rely on this party or this figure of authority or this institution so that they can help save you and they can help, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then lo and behold, that institution, that person of power, that political party doesn't do anything. And so we kind of stuck in this mindset. And that's one of the most prevalent things we saw and why we started the podcast, right? Is victim mindset, victim mentality. Stoicism is kind of the antidote to that because Stoicism teaches you, you never have to be the victim. Like you can be in a situation where you are the victim, right? We've both been in situations where we are the victim, but there's always a choice that we have realized where we can either say, yeah, I am the victim. Why is this happening to me? This sucks. My life is terrible. Why would God do this to me or something like that based on what your beliefs are? Or you can sit there and say, you know, this happened to me. Okay. Like, all right, how can I grow from this? How can I learn from this? Right? How am I going to get through this rather than just sitting there and kind of wallowing in how much of a victim you are? And so there's this agenda, I think, being pushed when we see like Ryan Holiday or people pushing Stoicism, A, to lump it in with what Stoicism really isn't, which is like hustle culture, broicism, all of the things that come with like misogyny and negative characteristics that were never present in Stoicism. Or B, just saying Stoicism is bad and doesn't work, even though it's influenced CBT, which is like one of the most influential modern therapy techniques. And there's studies that document like how beneficial Stoicism has been to people who start practicing it. But we don't want to listen to that. We want to listen to like the media who has those negative views because maybe they have an agenda to push. Just maybe.
Well, the thing too is with the victim mentality is one, you're just expecting people to do things for you because in the past things haven't been done for you, and not even for you specifically, but let's say you're grouped into a group of people. I'm going to take an example, right? Let's say you were in a group of, you know, you were a group of aliens, right? And in the past, your group of aliens had been denied the right to go to the grocery store, okay? But now you're able to go to the grocery store just like everybody else, okay? This is my example. And I'm not going to get into a real life example because I really don't want this podcast to get taken away, but just bear with me here, okay? But now every time you go to the grocery store, you have to remind people about how you were never allowed to go to the grocery store. And all these major like media corporations, right? They're like, "Remember that time when they couldn't go to the grocery store?" And now it's just this reoccurring thing that keeps getting back brought up when there's actually no more issue. I'm not saying, you know, there aren't any issues with these people going to the grocery store anymore and there's not conflicts within the grocery store, but it's to keep bringing up this idea that actually died a very long time ago that society has moved past. Take that for example. Now you have these people who are constantly living in this mentality where they expect things to be done for them because there is a history of things not being done for them. Well, that leads to two things. One, just the basic victim mentality, and you're honestly pretty miserable to be around. But two, that's going to translate into other parts of your life. You're never actually going to get anything done because that mentality is going to translate into your work. It's going to translate into your family. You're going to expect things to be done for you. Where Stoicism, great approach. You say, this did happen to me. I'm in control, not of what happened, but how I react to it and how I change it. But unfortunately, when the mass media is controlling basically every narrative you see on the news now, it's very easy to say, oh, this is the news, this is the truth, this is what's happening, and so this is why I should think it. Instead of Stoicism, it says, well, maybe everything you're told, that's not entirely true. You should always be questioning more and more. You should always be trying to learn something more. I saw something interesting, and this is just a conspiracy, so I'm going to just leave it there. But this guy, it was on an Instagram reel, and he was like, if we have, you know, the media today that's like controlling narratives and whatnot, imagine how incorrect parts of history are. And he looked at the history books, and he said, all of the history books in American schools are owned by the same people. And so you think if they really wanted to take something out of the history books, they might be able to do that because every single book is owned by the same company. It's really just this idea of controlling what is seen and not seen. When I was talking to some friends from India that I met at my school, they were talking about how in India, they essentially learn everything from the outside about America. The outside world knows a lot more about America than America knows about the outside world. And that's simply because of, one, our media, but also just the education system around it and what we're actually exposed to, right? He was like, the guys I was talking to, they were like, yeah, well, you know, America, it's kind of iffy. You know, there's a lot of things in India that America has that you guys don't know that we have because you're never taught. But India is actually not terrible. There's definitely conflicts there, but it's not this like disgusting, you know, in trouble third world country that America thinks it is. It's not like that at all.
Yeah, I don't know. Conspiracies from Instagram reels, maybe not that valid, but that one has some validity to it. There's the famous kind of theory that history is written by the victors, right? So even if textbooks weren't controlled by one company or a few companies, the historical accounts of things that happened 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, are from the perspective of people who won. And the losers, you know, their history kind of got squashed. They got washed over by whoever won. So we don't really know the history. And even besides that, the history that is available to us, we're not knowledgeable of. I think this isn't really a generational issue. I think Gen Z kind of gets like it thrown at us that we're like, oh, we don't know the history of the country. We don't know civics, blah, 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 blah. I've met some people, especially at our high school, who definitely did not know those things. So there's some truth to it, but I don't think it's more than any other generation. But there's people out there who just don't know the history. I was having a discussion around how the U.S. government treats its citizens, and somebody wasn't even aware of what Operation Northwoods was, which, you know, the CIA operation that went to the president's desk and then got vetoed, where they would have killed thousands of American citizens in terrorist attacks to justify going to war with Cuba. But we there's just things like that that are publicly available that we have like no knowledge of. Now, for me, like that, my knowledge of that has greatly influenced how I view government, because if they were willing to do that 70 years ago when they had less power and less money, what are they willing to do now? Not trying to, you know, push any political theories there, but just that kind of just basic sentiment, right? So it's just being aware, right? And being informed, being knowledgeable. That's the thing that I think we kind of bridge the gap between philosophy and politics, is just being like aware and being knowledgeable. We try and stay as apolitical as possible. That's certainly hard to do in today's world, and that's why you see politics kind of bleed onto the podcast. But like you said, we stay away from it because we enjoy doing the podcast. We enjoy having a philosophy-based podcast. We don't want it to get taken down. That would be pretty sad. So we stay away from those kind of topics. But
yeah, well, the thing is, too, is a lot of them aren't political topics. They're just real-world topics or social issues that get labeled as political. Is kind of the issue, is they really have nothing to do with politics. The reason they're labeled as political is because campaigns and political parties like to take sides with these issues, and then it becomes political, but the issues don't actually stem from anything political at all.
Well, think about, we've talked about the Israel-Palestine thing a lot on this podcast, and we've stayed away from like looking at like the history of it or like the politics of it or like taking a side or anything. And it's just look at like how much philosophy can lend to your approach to the situation, especially as it relates to a lot of the protests we see. Like, just think about like being calm and, you know, being non-reactive and being really mild-mannered and embodying like courage and justice, right? You can do all those things in those protests, but they're strengthened if you have like a philosophical backing, I believe, and like an ethical code. So I completely agree with you. We stay away from political issues, but like philosophy can serve you very well as you enter like the political realm. Like you've told me a bunch about how like since you've implemented Stoicism and you've learned how to like stay calm during debates, like your skills, your argumentative skills have improved greatly. That works for everybody. We get so riled up in today's society when we're arguing with people, and you know, I say arguing because debates don't really happen, because debates are formal, debates are civil, and that's very rare. But just like arguing, we get, you know, we get red in the face, we get very flustered, and just, you know, the ability to remain calm, you know, take your emotions out of the picture, something we don't see a lot of in the current protests. A lot of people are red in the face, a lot of people are yelling at each other, and so people are going to say, well, oh, you're talking about Israel-Palestine, it has to be political. No, it doesn't have to be political. That's That's kind of the basic argument here. It's certainly a political issue, but if you apply philosophy, especially some of the tenets of Stoicism, it becomes a lot easier. You're not walking around angry all the time. You're not walking around frustrated all the time. And now I think there's certainly some validity to being angry about the situation, because being calm, being passive, and being nonchalant about children being bombed is not great. I think we should really care about that issue. But there's a difference between being emotional and then being invested. Being invested means like the emotions come from the place of like caring deeply about the issue. Being emotional just means I'm just going to be upset. And again, lo and behold, it's not a political argument. It's just a basic, like you said, common sense social issue argument of how do you best approach the situation, no matter what your opinion is.
Well, the thing is, too, is when you approach it from a political perspective, at least in America, I know you and I both feel the same way about this, that the two-party system is not great. And so when you approach it with a two-party system mindset, then you're approaching it with the mindset that one answer is right, one answer is wrong. That whatever the it's a zero-sum game. So whatever victory one side accrues, the other side is going to accrue an equivalent loss. And that's completely untrue, because we know that with issues like that, and if you approach it from a Stoic lens, Stoics were never one side is always right, one side is always wrong. Stoics were open to compromise. Stoics were open to negotiation. They were open to all ideas, because no idea is a bad one, except for maybe like, let's commit genocide of a ton of people. That's a pretty bad idea. But you get what I'm saying. You get the point. And so I think, and yeah, to your point, like you said, when I was in LA and I was really getting in touch with the podcasts and I was really practicing what I was preaching with these Stoic principles, there were debates that I had, and I say debates because I think even if one person can remain calm, it's more of a debate than if both people are arguing with each other. But there were debates I had where I was not as informed as the person I was debating with, or just not even debating, just discussing ideas and opinions with. And yet just the art of being calm and rational and using common sense in an argument without getting flustered, it took me a long way. And in the end, it actually led the person and the people that I was talking to sit back and question where they were coming from and sort of think about things in a different light. And I'm not saying that means that I won. I think that means Stoicism won. I think Stoicism, the art of being Stoic in an argument or in a debate, and if that allows the other person to question their initial beliefs, I think that's the greatest art of all, right? It's taking someone out of their closed-mindedness or fixed-mindedness, or not even that, just taking someone out of their set beliefs and allowing them to discover other ones. I think that's the biggest win of all, is allowing us to explore other solutions or other options, or if we want to make it political, you know, other like negotiations with other countries or foreign affairs and things like that.
Yeah, the two-party system, I think it has to do everything with like labels. We have an episode on labels. We talk about labels a lot, and labels really are pointless. Like you mentioned, you know, the fixed mindedness, like they just close your mind off to things. The two party system is just a labeling system, right? Where you see people on this side are like, conservatives are X, Y, and Z. They suck. They're terrible people. And then they're like, oh, liberals are woke and blah, 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 blah. And when you generalize such a broad population, never goes well. Way generalizations. And one interesting thing I always think about labels, and I don't think we brought this up during our labels episode, is like labeling yourself as a Stoic. Historically, like Seneca never labeled himself as a Stoic. Like I don't think it was mentioned like specifically in his works, himself being a Stoic. Marcus Aurelius never called himself a Stoic, neither did Epictetus. It was about lived values. I just think it's interesting. I've kind of, even though, you know, we have a podcast centered around Stoicism, Stoicism is central to a lot of my moral values. I hesitate to label myself a Stoic anymore because of the fact that like it just closes yourself off from other schools of philosophy, especially as somebody who, I'm really big into reading other schools of philosophy. We have Kant's Critique of Pure Reason here, which is a horrendous book to try and read. It's his best work, which is not saying much because I don't really believe in deontology, but it's terrible to read. It's so awful to read. But my point being, I think just avoiding labels altogether, even like with your values, just call them your values. There's nothing wrong with labeling yourself as a Stoic, I guess, because we both have experienced it. It's a pretty great thing to be.
There's definitely worse things to label yourself as. We'll just go.
Yeah. I think you know, labeling yourself as a Stoic means you're content. So in a society that doesn't seem very content, that's great. Like, but in all honesty, like if we're really walking the walk here with labels, I think I hesitate to call myself a Stoic anymore. Right? A lot of those values align with what Stoicism is, but they're my values and they might change. And I don't want to feel like resistant to that, because I have to think like, oh, wait a minute. How does this relate to Stoicism? Like, no, just how does it relate to being a good person? And again, like I'll make the argument that most things that I find in my life lead to good ethics, good decisions, being a good person, also align exactly with what the teachings of Stoicism are. But we don't want to restrict ourselves to like one school of philosophy. Because like these schools were made, what, like 2,000 years ago, a lot of these schools? Like modern trends change, and so you need to be able to have your philosophical leanings and your moral beliefs change with them, right?
Yeah, well, and it's funny because our podcast is quite literally called The Gen Z Stoic. But when we say that, it's more of saying, what would a Stoic in Gen Z do? Someone who does label themselves as a Stoic, or someone who is a practitioner of Stoicism, what would that look like in Gen Z? What would that look like in the current digital age? And so you're right. I have no shame in labeling myself as a Stoic myself, because I know what being a Stoic entails. Now, if I were talking to somebody, I would say I am a practitioner of Stoicism. I would not say I am a Stoic, because that means I am only a Stoic to people who are closed-minded. Now, being a practitioner of Stoicism means I am practicing these certain values. And I think because you mentioned, as we have paralleled Stoic values with simply good moral values, we say we're just working on being a good person. But where do our good person values come from? Well, for us, it's Stoicism. That's where it's pretty much deeply rooted. But that goes for everybody, right? Everyone tries to be a good person, but not everybody's a practitioner of Stoicism. So everybody has a set belief system that they've rooted somewhere, and they have paralleled it to being a good person. And that's exactly what we've done. So the Gen Z Stoic stands for more than just being a Stoic. It stands for, you know, how can you be a practitioner of Stoicism in your everyday life, not just being a Stoic? Because anybody could say, yeah, I'm Stoic. I got into an argument the other day and I didn't even react. I'm Stoic. It's like, okay, but do you live by courage, wisdom, justice, and temperance? Sure, you may have dealt with temperance there, but are you a coward or are you courageous? So, and that's not saying you have to knock everyone on the head in order to be a Stoic. That's why we're practitioners of Stoicism, because in order to practice, that means you're going to make mistakes. And obviously, we're not perfect with Stoicism. This has been a journey. We've only been doing this podcast for a year and a half, which is kind of crazy because it feels like we started not that long ago. But everything is a practice. Faith, religion, that's a practice, right? Whether you are, and if you're in philosophy and you believe in existentialism, that's a practice. Taoism, that's a practice. Everything is a practice, which means it will be imperfect. And Stoics knew that. Stoics knew that everything is meant, like the imperfections and everything make things perfect, if that makes sense. Because everything has its flaws, that's what makes everything worth, you know, trying or experiencing or whatnot. So I think that's a good point.
That's living with accordance with nature, right? The imperfections aspect, like the imperfections were made by nature, so we should appreciate the imperfections as we do the perfections of an object. And one thing I think about when we talk about like contemporary Stoicism, how many times have you heard like athletes in like their interviews that, and they're like, I was just completely Stoic today or something like that. Like they sink a clutch shot or something. They don't let their emotions get the best of them for like that event. And they're like, oh, I was feeling really Stoic today. And now I'm pretty sure they mean like the small s Stoic, which is like a adjective, versus like capital S Stoic, which is the full set of beliefs. And I think you're right. We talk about, we label ourselves the Gen Z Stoic. I think that leaves a lot of room for different interpretations of Stoicism, because like I said, this was founded, what, 2,000 years ago, give or take?
Not the podcast, the School of Philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually 2,000 years old. That'd be great. Yeah, but it was founded 2,000 years ago, and we've mentioned things like there's Stoic philosophers who are like, don't read books, right? Like limit yourself to like a few good books that you can rely upon and just reread them. That's not necessarily bad advice. But they didn't live in a time where books were severely undervalued, because books were all they had, right? They didn't grow up in a time where there was social media that replaced books. There were ebooks that replaced books. So I think like that's just one example I can think of the top of my head, where maybe we have to shift away from what Stoicism taught 2,000 years ago and instead say, in an age where like our attention span is this long, and social media has kind of replaced books, and our generation does like to read books, which I'm very surprised by knowing some people, but generally our generation likes to read books. But like books have become less popular because they've been replaced by all these electronic things. So now is the time to take a stand and say, no, read books more. Reading books is great. It's not a waste of time. You learn a lot from them. A lot more than you're going to learn from scrolling through social media or anything like that. So just one example off the top of my head. And a lot of people I see that are more towards like the academic side of philosophy take issue with that for some reason, whether it's not just us specifically, but like a lot of like the Daily Stoic and other Stoic channels kind of change the teachings of Stoicism a little bit. And they say, well, they're just doing that so they can get an audience and make money, and they're ignoring what Stoicism really means. That's not true. I think the Daily Stoic, many Stoic channels have a good understanding, and I think we also have a good understanding of what Stoicism means. We have just risen above like saying Stoicism is perfect and we don't need to alter anything, and we just look at it critically, right? The dichotomy of control is awesome. The concept of amor fati is awesome. Memento mori, awesome. These things that are inherent in Stoicism are great. They are awesome. They're what Stoicism is about. We fully incorporate them. But there are also some not so great teachings that are part of Stoicism. Just like any other school of philosophy, right? Like there's some not so great parts of it. And so our acknowledgement of that is not saying like, oh, well, this is part of it, so we have to live it. It's how can we improve these things so that we can make it better? And so that's what I don't get. I'm on the Stoicism Reddit a lot and the philosophy Reddit a lot. And I talk philosophy online a lot because my mother and my friends outside of you obviously don't want to talk about philosophy. And they're like, dude, quit it. Like, shut up. Nobody cares. So I have to go online for that. But there's just that kind of argument online and like the more academic spaces where it's like, oh, these modern Stoics, like they don't acknowledge the full sphere of Stoicism. We do. It's just, we don't have to live all of the Stoic like teachings because some were wrong. It's like the concept of a lot of scientific people who were very, very intelligent, but didn't have the technology we do back like 500 years ago. They were wrong, but we still appreciate their greatness, and we have now changed their teachings, but still acknowledge their intellect. You know, philosophy and science aren't hand in hand there. There's obviously the metaphysics of philosophy that goes more into the scientific aspect. They don't go hand in hand, but there's similar arguments to be made there. We can change the teachings and still fully acknowledge like, yeah, the Stoics had some things that were dumb, but that was also 2000 years ago and we have improved now. So we can now improve the teachings.
Well, and the biggest thing that I can think of, like example wise, that we acknowledged is in Stoicism, but we don't necessarily agree with. And for the record, because we don't disagree with it, doesn't make it wrong. And it's just something that we're looking at Stoicism stoically, right? We know that it's not going to be perfect, so we're going to stoically analyze the school of philosophy itself. But the biggest example I can think of is Zeno believing, the founder of Stoicism, the creator, Zeno. He was all for polygamy. And Ren and I, after seeing that, were like, no, not really. I'm not going to really agree with that. But that's not saying that we don't appreciate Zeno as a whole. I mean, without Zeno, they're probably, I mean, at least not yet, or much later, the school of Stoicism wouldn't have been founded, right? So we can still appreciate his works and his opinions and the things that we do agree with. We don't always have to agree with everything. And that's sort of the interesting thing, is because the world has changed so much, but human nature hasn't really changed that much. That's why Stoicism is so applicable. It's like, yes, we've, you know, the book example, right? Obviously, there weren't as many books back then. There also wasn't social media back then, so that's why they had their opinions. Now, you can go to like thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of libraries across the world and see and get all kinds of books. But you can also go on your phone and replace books with just about anything you want. So the world has very much changed. But the human nature, the fundamentals of human nature are still the exact same, right? Humans are a little bit different now. Our attention spans are that of a goldfish. We're easily angered and thrown off our rocker by things that we would not have been thousands of years ago. We're a lot softer now, but we're still humans. It's not like we're some new species that emerged in the age of technology. And I think that's why Stoicism is making such a comeback, is because in an era filled with, you know, things that are superficial and things that are very surface level, we are seeking more. We're seeking something with purpose. And Stoicism sort of roots you, whoever you are,
in a purpose if you choose to practice it wholeheartedly. And that's what it did for us. And now we're not saying that everyone who practices Stoicism is going to say, yeah, I agree with everything they say. Obviously, we don't. And Stoicism may not click for you, but it's a start. I think if everyone were to truly look into Stoicism, and we've said this before, they would find at least one thing that they would agree with. And that's honestly for any school of philosophy. You don't have to start with Stoicism. You can start with Chinese philosophy, Taoism. You gave me that book, and I really loved it. I forget what it was called. I have it back in LA. I wasn't able to bring it here. But there was some Confucianism in there and some other stuff like that. Or you could go into existentialism. I personally think it's very interesting, the existential topics. You could go into metaphysics. You could go into all of these areas of study. Ryan's shaking his head at the metaphysics, and I'm not advocating for it. I'm just saying you can definitely go into any sort of philosophy and find something that you like. I took a philosophy course this past semester, and I did not enjoy it at all because my professor was horrible. However, what I did find interesting is I never actually knew what the word philosopher meant in terms of its Latin roots or its Greek roots when I started the podcast. Philo is
love,
and then bia is knowledge. So it's the love of knowledge. So the philosopher is the lover of knowledge. Yeah, I had a brain fart there. Thanks for picking me up. But it was like, yeah, because every form of philosophy, they're after one thing. And, well, not after one thing. But I've seen in all, Plato, Socrates, all these philosophers, they're all after one thing, and that is the truth. That is what is. They're all seeking their form of the truth, and they're trying to understand. I mean, that's the highest sought out good, essentially. And so if everyone were seeking their own truth, and they were to look at these schools of philosophy, or these forms of philosophy, if you will, and try and find something that resonates with them and be open-minded to these things, I think the world would just be finding purpose again. Whereas now, go on social media and it's skibbity sigma everywhere and your brain is falling apart and there's no purpose anywhere. Yeah, I'm sorry for saying that, but it's true. I see the kids come into the YMCA nowadays where I work and up in the gym. And they're just coming in and they're just saying these things that they're regurgitating off of social media. And granted, we did that all the time. And now we're saying, oh, it's gotten so much worse. But has it? Has it really gotten worse? Or is it just looking different? There's different trends and there's new trending words or trending phrases, right? Or there's new slang. It's been the same forever, but it's just looking different as we get further down the line. But the same, principle is applicable to everybody. And that is that you can find your purpose if you go into something that was rooted deep in the pursuit of knowledge.
Yeah. I'm shaking my head at the metaphysics because just my personal opinion, metaphysics is the non-fun part of philosophy for me. So I don't know. Maybe people dig metaphysics. It's not fun to read for me. So I've stayed away from it. I just enjoy reading the more kind of ethics side. I think it's interesting of note of like the human nature thing. We, as humans, like we think that we're so different than we were like 2,000 years ago, but like a lot of the characteristics of society are the same. And I think of it like we're telling the same story. Like when we think about like hero movies and action movies and things like that, they follow the same path of stories that were written like 2,000 years ago. Like Homer, when he was writing like tragedies and stories of heroes, the hero's journey, right? We see that diagram where there's like the hero's journey where like they lose somebody important to them. I don't know the hero's journey, so I'm actually not even going to try and paraphrase, but like we've repeated that for 2000 years. So we repeat our entertainment sources for 2000 years. Obviously we're going to repeat a lot more. And so that's why, philosophy is still so applicable and it's still relevant and it's still being expanded upon. Now, an interesting thing of note is like you said, Stoicism really was dead until Ryan Holiday brought it back and he brought in a new wave of contemporary Stoicism. So I'm just curious. I'd like to hear your opinion first, and then I can kind of delve into mine. We are now, what, like 10 years past its comeback? Where does Stoicism, do you think, go from here? Like, does it really latch on, or do you think it's just going to stay where it is, or is it going to die out again? Now, I'm obviously hopeful that it stays around for a while, but I don't know. I'm just curious. Mateo, you think it's going to stay around for a while?
It's interesting because it made a really big surge as well with Tate, because that was one thing he talked about. And when he was extremely popular around the internet, it seemed like Stoicism was as well. And now I would hate for stoicism in today's day and age, and I don't believe it is, but I would hate for it to be a thing where it rises with popular influencer figures on the internet and then kind of dies down as they die down. But I, like you said, like you are, I'm optimistic for the future. I think what Ryan Holiday has started, if it is seen by the right people, can be continued. And I think it can be grown again. I think more people, I think a lot of people know what stoicism is, because when a lot of people ask me like, oh, what's your podcast about? And I'm like, we base it around the Stoic school of philosophy. Like, that's really cool. So it's not that people don't know what stoicism is, right? That's not the issue. Now, maybe the people of Gen Z don't know as much about it, because most of the people that ask me are adults. And so they're familiar. But the reason I think we're targeting Gen Z specifically, not targeting, but we are hoping that this reaches Gen Z specifically, this podcast, is because it kind of fell off, right, until Holiday picked it up. And that was 10 years ago. But 10 years ago, we weren't really on the internet as much, and we weren't really consuming everything. We weren't as aware. So I think if the Stoic message can reach the right people, it will be continued. But I think if people only see Stoicism in this, like you said, the broicism or the alpha male context, it's done. I mean, it's kind of in jeopardy, because that's not what it's about. If people can, and that's exactly why the only reason I really hope this podcast can really grow is so it can reach people and hopefully deliver the message of Stoicism that we are trying to portray in the correct light that we believe is correct. Because then I think if Gen Zers are influenced by the message that we're giving out and they see it as positive, then they will relay it to their kids or to their peers and whatnot. Just how Stoicism grew in the beginning, right? Stoicism started with 12 people-ish on that back porch, and it was being taught, and then they went out and they told all their friends about it, and then it slowly expanded into what it is today. So I think if we can reach, you know, the right people who are willing to take action, then it'll grow. And I'm optimistic that Stoic values will, you know, be present in the future, because I think there will always be a small batch of people who believe in it. But whether those people are willing to use their voice to stand up and defend Stoicism and keep it alive, that's a different story, right? We are willing to build this platform up and voice it. So regardless, there always are going to be people that believe and practice Stoicism. Whether it's going to remain not necessarily a popular, but I guess like a mainstream belief that is known, pretty well known amongst a lot of people, that's a different story. So I could see it going down two paths, right? Getting into the hands of the right people with the right message, or staying kind of what it was around the COVID era, and then kind of, you know, spiking up here and there depending on who's promoting it.
Yeah, no, you hit it on the head. I think it really just depends on who's like carrying the message, like who's the, you know, the face of Stoicism. Not that there really should be one specific face or anything like that, but if it's people who, it's like Ryan Holiday, who are doing it for the right reasons and are well educated, and dare I say ourselves, right, and instead of, you know, people who hijack it for broicism purposes, then it will be successful. Because I think that for all the kind of hate that we get, and for the controversial statements that we still make somehow that are controversial, you know, it's the people who I'm really trying to sound humble here, but like it's the people like us who are doing it to like spread the message of like living a good life rather than like being extravagantly successful, where it should really resonate with people. And I think another reason why we targeted Gen Z is because we need it at a generational level. And I think Gen Z, more so than millennials or Gen X, is the generation who might accept Stoicism. Because in our generation, right, we've rejected a lot of institutions. Like the two-party system. A lot of people in our generation hate the two-party system. A lot of the people in our generation believe higher education has failed and it needs a lot of reform. A lot of people believe healthcare in this country sucks. Like, our generation is very negative towards a lot of institutions that have been held for a long time. Like, we had Ryan on the podcast, and his platform is completely revolutionizing the mental healthcare world and that kind of institution of like therapy and things like that. There's so many people in our generation who are like that, and I think Stoicism goes really well with that mindset. Like, it pairs really well with that mindset to challenge those institutions and like stand up for what you believe in, right? Obviously, one of the four cardinal virtues is justice, and that seems to be another, it seems to be, justice seems to be a pillar of value in our generation as well. So I think that there,
and courage, I would say courage, yeah, is almost exactly there, because we're having the courage to go against it, right? As well,
we just struggle with temperance. We struggle with self-discipline. That's what we struggle with in this generation. So Stoicism is a good pair there, because it's like we have the ideas, we have the vision of what we want to do, but a lot of people in our generation struggle with motivation. And I think that boils down to self-discipline and that temperance aspect. So that's where Stoicism comes in. Both of us have had our individual passions that I feel like we've pursued more heavily since we've integrated Stoicism into our lives. Me with a lot of political activism stuff and getting a lot of change there. And I think, you know, it's just something that our generation, if they truly look into it and they do utilize resources, not just podcasts and podcasters, but actually reading the texts and incorporating the knowledge into their life, our generation is going to be great. Like, we're going to be a great generation because we're going to have all four of those values and we're going to apply it to great things. It does boil down to, you know, where the platform is, but I don't think it's going away. I don't think it's going to go to a dead space like it did for so many years before Ryan Holiday and everybody of contemporary Stoicism.
I agree. And as much as I hate to credit it, I would say social media is a big factor in that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think it'll die again, but I don't know. I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic, like you said, that it takes off even further from where it is now. And we have a lot of people. I think it'd be really great if we had a candidate, a political candidate who had Stoic values. That would be awesome. A president or somebody in some sort of power who had Stoic values and talked about it openly. That would be great. That'd be somebody who I would feel comfortable voting for, because I don't feel comfortable voting for anybody right now, but not to get political. So just like that kind of popularization. And we talk about all the time with our podcast how like it's going to take a lot of time. We talked about at the beginning of this episode, right? We're at like 60 episodes. Usually takes like 400. It's just laying the groundwork. I think right now our generation, you know, we kind of correlate really closely to that. We're laying the groundwork. And I think Stoicism maybe is part of that groundwork, and we're going to see it pop up even more than it is right now in the near future. That's what I'm hopeful for.
I've actually had a very similar thought about the presidential candidates, and if we had a candidate who was like the Stoic Party or something like that, you know, how beneficial that could be to a country if somebody really stood up and spoke in front of a lot of people very calmly, very rationally, not within a specific agenda in mind. Obviously, everyone's going to have their own personal agenda to an extent. You could argue that Stoicism is our personal agenda that we're pushing out, right? But with an agenda that's not meant for their gain. That's not meant for a party's gain. That's meant for the country's gain and the people's gain. And now every candidate's going to stand up there and say, I'm for the country. I'm for the country. Well, it's pretty clearly reflected in the actions and the policy that that's not entirely true. Okay. And it doesn't take a genius to see that. You are far better versed in politics than I am. And even I can see it, that each candidate has a specific agenda in mind for their party. And the reason that that's a problem now is because it's creating, and it has always been, but specifically now is because of how much division that's going to create and how much division it has created. And so I think you're right. I think this generation is courageous. Matter of fact, I know we're courageous. I know that we want justice. We want what is right. We are courageous to stand up and do things. I mean, look how many people will stand up and protest for what they believe in. That takes courage. That's not easy. Look how many people will take a platform and argue or push for an idea that they think is right. That takes both courage and justice. We're also not stupid, right? Well, kind of, because we have a lot of people who don't know the basics about like geography or politics or the basics, right? But that doesn't make people stupid. That just makes us uninformed. That doesn't mean that we're unable to learn. It just means we haven't learned. Now there's definitely people, but there's people in every generation that are maybe not the sharpest knife in the drawer, right? The brightest bulb in the box. But that's not saying that our generation is dumb. Our generation is not dumber than any other generation, right? We're not like the stupid generation. But look how we've grown up. I mean, kids are getting phones when they're four, so that's quite literally changing the neuroscience and the connections in their brain, so we're thinking differently. But that doesn't mean we don't have the potential to still be a great generation. I would say if there's one area where we are struggling, you're right, it is temperance. We're very emotional. Things get very emotional. The media is very emotional. And when that's the majority of the information that people are consuming, we're going to copy and also be emotional, right? You see debates. You see, you know, left and right movements. Everywhere you go, it's emotional. Social media is very emotional. Everything is targeted to your emotions to make you think or act a certain way, essentially. Fear-mongering in the news, marketing tricks on social media. Everything is emotional. So if we can sort of recognize that, and I think that's the biggest thing with Stoicism initially that we were drawn to was the managing of emotions, not the suppressing of emotions, but the regulation. If we can learn to regulate our emotions and separate reason from how we feel, then we are on the track to success as this generation.
Yeah. And not only temperance, but I think like there's a lot of people that I talk to who are like around the school of Stoicism. And another thing that, you know, I forgot to mention when we were talking about the future of Stoicism is like spaces like X and Facebook. You know, we got connected to those spaces with Benny last week. We didn't even know those existed until last week, but they're like thousands of people who are in the Stoicism. You know, you mentioned social media. That's just another great way of like a great platform, right? Like Stoicism back in Zeno's time was taught on a little porch in a community. And now we have what is like the global version of that, which is social media, right? Like we can create our own kind of stoa. Like we have our porch here, and it's just instead of being confined to Athens and the people who walk by, we now have a megaphone that blasts it to the world. And I think that's great. That's like we talk about there are some pros of social media. That's one of them for sure. Connection, networking. And so hopefully we get to take advantage of those spaces in the future. But that's just another reason why I'm optimistic for the future of Stoicism. And something that, you know, kind of mentioning here is with the temperance and everything is that there's also like the promotion of family values and like, you know, being a high value person towards a family that I think is incorporated in Stoicism. I think it's Seneca who talks about like one of the best things in life is to, you know, find a wife and start a family, right? There's some of those kind of traditional family values, which we are both very fond of that are inherent in Stoicism. And, you know, there's also like the teachings of like what a good man is, what a good person is that can be easily applied to families. And why I bring that up is because our generation, you know, record high levels of polygamy, divorce rates are really high. You know, the rates of starting families going down. Everybody has microplastics in them now, so that's going to suck for fertility. So there's just like a bunch of things that kind of point towards the erosion of family. And I think if we erode the family unit, it doesn't even have to be a traditional family, but like just a solid family of that's a support for you. When that erodes, I think the fabric of society is gone. Because, right, like we've talked about this before, if you can't respect like your parents or like a figure of authority, now obviously if there's bad parents, you shouldn't do that. But if there was more Stoicism, more family values, we wouldn't have bad parents, right?
Or a lot less of them anyway.
Yeah, a lot less. But it, like if you can't find somebody to respect who's like in a position of authority and is your mentor and gives you advice, then how are you going to be respectful once you enter the world, right? You're going to come out there and think, oh, I don't have to respect anybody. Like I made it on my own, blah, 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 blah. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to respect anybody. It's just one example. So I think Stoicism, it's not inherent. It's not one of the first things you think about when you talk about Stoicism, but there's a lot of family values there. And I think as we see kind of those going by the wayside, if Stoicism kind of gains more of a foothold in our generation, I'm hopeful that can turn around and that we can see more healthy families. Because I truthfully like do believe if we can see more healthy families, we see a more healthy society. And that's one of the keys to bringing our country back together. I think it's not talked about whatsoever when we talk about like division in this country. But if we want to solve that, how about we prioritize family more? It doesn't have to be traditional families, but traditional family values, I would say, where, you know, you're there for one another. It's a support network and people bring different things to the table. There's just more of that. I think that's one of the keys to eliminating division in this country. And it's something that if you follow Stoicism, you'll find goes very well with that.
Yeah, I full-heartedly agree. And that's also a big reason. This, I'm not making this a religious thing at all, but that's also part of the reason why I started getting into Christianity a lot was the importance of family. Now, it's important to note that we're not advocating for the traditional like family roles. We're just arguing for the traditional family characteristics. And what I mean by that is, like you said, taking care of one another, you know, protecting one another, loving one another unconditionally. Putting family over money is a big thing. Now, it's very hard today because back in the day, I mean, really only one person had to work to provide. But now it seems like both people have to really stress and work their butts off to make the money to provide for their family. And that's tough because that's another thing that's tearing up the family dynamic is the expense of living. And there's so many things in the world, and you listed, you know, a good amount of them that are kind of taking away from the, you know, the traditional family. And it sucks, because one of the things that I think this generation has, and it's not because they hate family or they hate people or they don't want a family, is people like, you know, I want to put my like career first. I want to get a lot of money first. I want to do all these things first before I have a family. And now there's nothing wrong, you know, with wanting to experience the world or, you know, have a great career and whatnot. But I think putting the de-emphasis on family in that way is sort of contributing to the problem. And the reason I say that is because, yes, it's important to be financially prepared before you have your family. But what I think is that if you have a, you know, a healthy family, you can live those experiences with them, right? You can do things as a family. Now, I'm not saying you have to do everything as a family. Obviously, my parents got sick of me, right? They were like, I need a break. I need to go on a vacation and hire a babysitter and whatnot. Totally understandable. But it's this big idea that family first. Your family is supposed to be the group of people that you trust the most and that you are the closest with. Now, this term has really emerged recently as, you know, family, but not by blood. And that's because you have people who aren't from healthy families who have to go and find other people like their friends who aren't related by blood, who are more of a family to them than the people in their own home. That's one is a beautiful thing that we can make those connections like that. But two, it's also kind of sad that people can't go home and feel safe and feel, you know, cared about or protected or heard. That's a big thing. And if you really, like Ren said, if you look into these Stoic values and these Stoic principles, following them and implementing them into your life, it's almost impossible to not build, you know, obviously not a perfect family because nothing's perfect, but a healthy one and a strong and stable family using Stoic values. One thing that Ren didn't mention today, but we've talked about a lot, is the violence in households, how practicing Stoicism would, and I, this obviously isn't a statistic because it's never been experimented, but we would bet essentially our life savings on the fact that if Stoicism were practiced in the household, you would see a drastic decrease in household violence. And specifically here, we're talking to the men. We are talking to the men of the household here for a couple reasons. One, the men need to be in the household. You see a lot of these kids growing up without fathers, and they grow up and they react. They're very reactive. They can be very impulsive. Men need to be in the house. The father needs to be in the house setting an example of what a good person should be. Now, the reason I say man is because typically for a son needs a good father, and so does a daughter. But specifically, sons need good fathers just as they need good mothers. And having a strong father in the household gives a son an example of what he should grow up to be like. Now, also another reason is because typically the majority of household violence is committed by the men, because we're more aggressive by nature. That's not an excuse. That's just what I'm saying. And so if men are practicing these Stoic values, you will see a lot of fathers that have temperance, that can control their temper, that we've all had the universal experience of doing homework at the table with dad at night, right? Where the dad gets very, very angry because you don't know what 3 times 7 is and you can't get it right. That's a pretty universal experience. And that's just a small example. But the point is being, if you have fathers who are patient and who are kind, you don't have to worry about them, you know, lashing out at you or getting angry, and you're not respecting them because you respect who they are. You're respecting them because you're afraid of what they can do if you don't. That's when we start to build that healthy family.
Yeah, I'm kind of wary to get in this argument, but I actually am under the belief that, now obviously, ideally, you have a two-parent household, and that's what we advocate for. But like, if you're having a single-parent household, I'm under the belief that men are more beneficial when it's more beneficial to young men when it's a single mother rather than a single father, because a lot of those like aggressive tendencies, like you said, and like the masculinity aspect, I think come more naturally versus there's like a learning curve of how to be kind, how to be tender, like how to kind of temper that as a man, because you need both. I think like as a man, we've done an episode on traditional masculinity. We've kind of redefined masculinity a little bit, but I think it's like a real man is somebody who is adaptable. And like, so what I mean by that is when mental fortitude or physical strength or things that are traditionally masculine are required, you're able to do that. You're able to have that mental strength, hold down the fort, be able to physically do tasks. That's great. You also need to be able to know when to be gentle, when to be kind, when to be compassionate. And then you also need the wisdom to discern between the two. Those are the three things I think you need. And I think those two, the wisdom and like the physical strength, the mental fortitude aspect, Speaking from, I think, both of our experiences, there wasn't necessarily, right, like a father out there. Like, we kind of learned that on our own. Stoicism certainly helped. And I think it's easier for men to learn that rather than to learn, like, how to be gentle, how to be kind, how to be tender, which it's certainly possible for men to do both. I'm not saying that whatsoever. Like, it's easy to do both. I feel like you just got to put in the work to do that. But when you have that single mother aspect, you kind of learn that from an early age, and so that's ingrained. And so I think you know how to be more adaptable. And then, like, on the flip side of that, from, you know, a young woman aspect, I think the father is more important for, like, the same reason, right? Because the counterintuitive things that are harder to learn, a father can teach those to a daughter. So I'm wary of getting into that argument. Kind of curious what your opinion is on that. But, like,
I think you have a good point, because obviously for a large portion of my life, I was raised by a single mother, and obviously that's correct. And I've noticed that in my personal experience, that she taught me, you know, a lot of emotional things and how to be emotional and kind and gentle and whatnot. So I 100% agree. I think the aspect that I was getting at with men not being around as well is, I guess you could even say, more of just not a good father figure role model, one who's very in and out. Right. One who's very, I guess, not around, but is still technically around, but really isn't there. I guess it could be a better example.
The bare minimum.
Exactly. The bare minimum. Because it's going to differ in every scenario. You're going to have scenarios of all of them, but we're typically speaking to the majority right now. You know, if you have, right, a father that's doing the bare minimum, right, that's going to be different. And I can't really speak to that very much, because I don't know what that's like. For me, it's really been all or nothing. And so it's really interesting, though, to kind of look at what a Stoic father would look like, to paint that picture in my head, because I can't really imagine what it is like, or how it would affect the household. I can really only imagine that as myself, how I would implement it when I'm a father, and how, when I have kids, how I would do it. But I can't really imagine the effect it would have on myself, because at this point, I mean, I'm almost 19. And it's been just a really long time. So I agree with you. I think that, you know, you have a daughter growing up with a single dad, or a son growing up with a single mom. I think those are really interesting dynamics that are very good, that can be very good. I would say I would agree with that sort of, you know, teaching the opposite thing growing up, like you were saying. I think that's definitely true. But optimally, we would want both. In a good way. And the thing that's cool that could be misinterpreted as well is, and you mentioned this with Benny, and I thought it was a great point that you made, is the whole thing about being Stoic and being masculine or feminine, it really doesn't have anything to do with being masculine or feminine. It just has to do with being a good person, because anybody can be Stoic. And if anybody's Stoic, it's not about being Stoic, it's about being a good person ultimately. And you said, I don't really remember verbatim how you said it on the podcast with Benny last week, but it was such a good point, because it really... we have redefined, right, what traditional masculinity would look like to a Stoic, or traditional femininity to a Stoic. But what's more important than any of those things is how both of them were based around family. Both of them were based around putting family first, right, and the people that you love first. It wasn't about sticking to the roles or anything like that. It was about family and how everything should be family oriented. And I thought that was a great point. And then I'll let you elaborate on what you mentioned last week, but...
Yeah. So we did traditional masculinity, traditional femininity, and our conclusion for both, right, was that, you know, the traditional masculine man and the traditionally feminine female, like, they are equal, right? They are equal, but it doesn't look the same, right? And so what I think we mean by that, and I don't want to speak for you, Mateo, but I think we're very closely aligned on this topic, is that, like, they play different roles, but because they are both equally such a good person, they are equal, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, they can be equal but different. Like, they provide different things, but that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, their value. They're both equally as important.
And if you focus on just being a good person and not saying, well, I have to embody these specific traits because I'm a man, or these specific traits because I'm a woman, then you can adapt, right? So then if, like, you unfortunately are thrown into a scenario where you're a single father or you're a single mother, you can adapt and you can fulfill that role because you are such a good person, like, because you're going to learn how to fulfill that role and you have faith in yourself to do that. I was reflecting, honestly, after that episode. You remember after we put out the, like, masculinity episode, and then we literally, like, went into the speech and debate class to defend ourselves on it because there were, like, some people who are angry about it?
Yeah, I do.
I was just thinking, like, how proud of us I was in that moment, because we came in and there was a few specific people who, like, were obviously not agreeing with what we were saying and thought it was offensive and all the things like that. And then we spent, like, what, 20 minutes? It took 20 minutes of, like, answering questions.
If that. It wasn't even that long.
And all of a sudden they're like, okay, all right. And, like, I was just thinking about that after the episode, and I was like, people here, like, this is what a traditionally masculine man should look like, or this is what a traditionally female woman should look like, and they just get so angry, like, from the start. Like, how dare you talk about that issue? And it's another thing for me, it seems like a common thing we've mentioned with a lot of issues, where once you sit down, and like you said, you present it in a calm manner, and, you know, where the emotions are taken out of it, you just present it logically, and you just articulate what you're articulating, a lot of our generation agrees. Like, for some, like, we have this idea that, like, you know, the idea of gender and, like, roles and everything like that is this hot button issue in our generation. And it certainly is. But if you sit down and talk about it and just explain it, like, we have a lot of agreement on it. Like, I don't, like, and so I don't know. I was reflecting on that after our episode, because anytime we talk about masculinity on the podcast, I kind of go back to that, that moment. Because that was one of, like, the first moments of the podcast where I'm like, wow, we've really grown and we're doing, like, great things. I'm very proud of what we're doing. So it's a fond moment for me to recall. And anytime we talk about masculinity, I just think about that. So I miss those days.
Well, it was interesting too, because I had no idea who I was talking to. Like, you certainly knew some of them from speech and debate, but I was like, I don't even know any of these people who are, like, disagreeing with me, but it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Because the point that we were trying to get across could be told to anybody. And the way that we explained it, it wasn't in the form of, like, an agenda pushing manner. It was very just a calm deliverance. It was, here's what I think, here's why. And now I want your thoughts. And the thing that you said that we actually agree on a lot is true. I had a conversation with somebody the other day about gender and that whole hot topic, right? And we didn't ultimately, to the core values, disagree on really anything at all. But one thing that I think is really throwing us off is our definitions of words that we have, right? We define the words as something like, so whenever I need the definition word, I look it up from the Oxford Dictionary. Okay. I take it very literally. I like to have it on paper. I like it written down. Okay. Now, as a society, we also know that that's not always what's popular. Sometimes we take words that have different meanings behind them, and we can kind of, that's sort of how, that's how slang works, right? That's how all these things work. And so when you're using a word that to you means one thing and to someone else means another thing, you're going to think that you're enemies, that you're disagreeing. But actually, in reality, it's really just clarifying what you mean. And the only way you can do that is by being calm, right? If you're just yelling at each other, you're never going to figure that out, right? So the specific example was, I looked up the definition of woman, and it was in the Oxford, and no, I'm saying this and I'm not arguing for any side right now. I'm saying what happened. I looked up the definition of woman, and it was an adult biological female. Okay. And I said, that for me, that is my definition of what that is. And the person I was talking to was like, yeah, but that it could be someone who, like, identifies it. And I'm like, okay, so we're both agreeing though that that's what it is, but people are, like, using the term loosely. And so it's not that we're disagreeing morally, that people should be treated well, that people should be treated with respect, no matter what they think or believe. That's not the issue. The simple issue is just the terminology that we're having misunderstandings about. I think it's very rare. Well, it's not very rare, I guess, but the majority of our generation believes that everybody should be treated with respect. I think down to the core, we all believe that.
Or at least we should believe that.
We should, yeah. And if people don't, I would say that's probably something that you should really work with yourself on, because that's kind of the, like, I guess, to an extreme level, can be a fascist mindset that you should all conform to one ideology, and if you don't, then you're not respected. But the point being is that we're all not that different. We really are not that different. And I think if we can sit down, and I wish I sound like such a broken record every time I come on the podcast, because I say this every time. If we can just sit down and put the yapping and the yelling and the flustering aside and just talk to each other civilly and respectfully, we're going to get so far. We're going to make so much progress, and we're going to realize so much about the people that are around us that we didn't know before. And we're going to start to see ourselves more as humans instead of left or right or masculine or feminine or good or bad. It's really going to be kind of a moment where we see ourselves as united, which is what we need in the era of division.
That's actually a good point. Like, we treat words as like harmful, and like arguments as like harmful, and ideologies, like stances that aren't harmful, because they're certainly, I don't want to say that having a certain ideology is not harmful. Nazi Germany, obviously, if you had that ideology, that was pretty harmful. But a lot of modern day ideologies that aren't harmful get labeled as that just because you have an opinion that is in disagreement with mine that's somehow harmful. Shout out to my university for having a free speech policy they're trying to implement that says ideas are harmful. Just want to give a little shout out there for that. But it's that kind of idea, right? And it's funny that I mentioned my school. Like, it generates in education. It comes from media and education and from a lot of these institutions. They tell you, like, ideological conflict is terrible, and it's just like this awful thing. And if somebody disagrees with you, that, oh, they must be a bad person, and ideas can be harmful. All of these kind of things that dissuade you from like having a conversation with your neighbor, right? And now we can't get past the politics of anything, so you can't even have a conversation with your neighbor about like your trash cans, because you're like, oh, this person supports XYZ, they must be a terrible racist person or something like that. Or, oh, my neighbor supports this ideology, they must be this sensitive snowflake, whatever. Even though, like, you're just trying to have a conversation about, like, hey, can you move your trash cans or something? Like, just something that simple has now become clouded because of that.
And I think it's unhealthy, just to bring up that the extremities of both sides, whatever it is, are kind of, you know, magnified on social media to make it seem like all of them are this way and all of them are that way, you know, which kind of makes it worse.
Well, and I laugh too that some of the like extremes of both sides are very similar, right? Like, if you look at like the tendencies that we see from people who are so-called on the far left and so-called on the far right, a lot of they have different opinions, but a lot of their strategies and what we critique them on are very similar. So it's just ironic to me. So getting away from politics, though, I think we hope to have more conversations like this, like I mentioned, where we got to go into our classroom. Now, we were still in high school, so that was why, and have that discussion. But like, as we move forward, like, we've talked about like doing live episodes where like we like sit down in a park, and like if people come and join us, they come and join us. We want to have those conversations, and that's what I think. You know, we're the Gen Z Stoic. We talk about Stoicism a lot. Obviously, that's central to us. But like, if we can also be a beacon of just like open dialogue, and saying like we don't need to be so sensitive about these topics that we can't talk about them, and think that like it's painful to have discussions about this and we should avoid it. If we can be that beacon as well in our generation, that'd be great. It just speaks to, I think, we're very hopeful. We're very idealistic people in our generation, and we think that we can make a lot of change. And so hopefully we get there. Hopefully we get there. It's going to be a long and arduous process, because, you know, changing society means changing individuals one person at a time. And we're reaching more and more people. So we're kind of embodying that philosophy, because it's just one person after the other, and kind of snowballs. But hopefully in the near future, we can do things like that with the live episodes, with discussions, maybe call video calls, things of that nature. Because conversations like these, I think, hopefully are entertaining, first of all, because we don't want to put out boring episodes for our audience, and are also informative and helpful. So if we can do those three things, I think that's kind of our checkbox for every episode. And that's what we want to move forward with.
Yep. I guess only point to just close with that I was going to add on for you is the Stoics would combat cancel culture, which is why it's important that we're pushing for open dialogue as well, is because the cancel culture ideology kind of says, you know, you say one thing that is presumed to be bad by mainstream and you're done. Everything that you've worked for, gone. Everything that you've built up, gone. No, you can't come back from it, gone. And that's kind of wrong for a couple of reasons. One, I mean, that's kind of taking away this art of forgiveness that comes with Stoicism, is, you know, we all have friends who have made mistakes. I've done wrong. You've done wrong. Does that mean that we should all stop being friends with each other and hate each other because we've done one wrong thing? No, we forgive and we move on. So that's one thing. But also, I guess, alluding more to the free speech part of it, is every idea besides the bad ones are good. You know what I mean? And by the bad ones, I mean, like, you, we want to take extreme examples, go back to 1930s.
Every idea that does not promote harm or like abject like discrimination towards somebody is a good idea, is a positive contribution.
Yeah. Exactly. And so that's why we're open to all ideas. If we are, you know, our ideas are in disagreement with other people's, we want to know. If you have a view on something that maybe we haven't covered, or you see something a little differently, we want to know. The live episodes would be really cool, because then we could interact with people in real time rather than just over comments or, you know, reviews. And we appreciate all the comments and reviews, but if we can grow large enough to where we'd actually get people to show out to do a live event, that would be pretty cool. And we, Ren and I, have talked about maybe road tripping at some point, just going around and speaking at numerous locations around the US, which would be a big move. So mark our words on the 9th episode of season 3 that is something that we would like to do. But yeah, ultimately, the Gen Z Stoic wants to be a beacon for people who want to be open-minded and learn. And we're optimistic that Stoicism will stay alive. We think that if it gets into the hands of the right people and it reaches the right audience, that it's not going to die down. We don't think it's going to die down regardless, but we think that it can grow into something bigger like it used to be, which we believe would drastically help the generation.
Yeah. I feel like we are the embodiment. It's not a Stoic quote, but it's something that can be paraphrased into a lot of Stoic quotes, that it's be the change you want to see in the world. And I think that's, you know, we have a lot of big dreams. We talk a lot of big game in terms of live episodes, wanting to tour. We were talking about going to Greece before we hit record, seeing where Stoicism was born. So we have a lot of big dreams, and we're hoping that our audience and what we say is impactful enough that we are able to fulfill those dreams through the podcast. And it's kind of that symbiotic relationship where, as we hopefully are informative and help people, truly help people with their lives and becoming a better person, we are sort of reciprocated with being able to spread that message to more people, and also some enjoyable experiences that can inform us so that we can then in turn inform people better. So ultimately, we have the big dreams of being the change we want to see in our generation and really being leaders. And we're hopeful that one day that happens. We're pretty confident it will be. And once that point happens, we hope to inspire even more people to do that, because it shouldn't be just us. If we had more people who are our age who are doing Stoic podcasts, that would be tremendous. That would be awesome. And so my final piece of advice, I'm a broken record too, because I feel like I say this a lot, but if you're listening to this and you have a passion, you have a big dream, drop what you're doing right now and go chase it. Obviously, you know, make smart decisions. Don't abandon everything. Right? Have a backup plan, have something that keeps you, you know, sustained, but chase that dream and go be the change you want to see in the world. So this has been a little bit of a different episode format. We tried a little bit more conversational, kind of back and forth. We'll see how it goes. You know, we get like 3-4 people who listen to the end of the episode, so they'll hear this, but we'll see how this episode goes. And if those 3 or 4 people really like this episode format, let us know, and we'll keep doing it like this. So with that being said, this has been this week's episode of the Gen Z Stoic Podcast. I've been your co-host, Ren.
And I've been your co-host, Mateo. We will see you all next week.